The Press Box is here to catch you up on the latest media stories. Hosted by Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker, these guys have the insight on the biggest stories you care about. Check out The Press Box on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
We got a fun podcast today, a little different. NFL, bottom five franchises moving forward, we'll do that. Austin Reeves, Lakers breakout story, and author Michael Wolff, who profiles some of the most ruthless people in America, and life advice. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. Today's open is a little more detailed, and shout out to Cerruti, who's just terrific with the ideas. And what I love about Cerruti planting the seeds for ideas for opens and different stuff we do on the podcast, back to the radio show days, is he can give me 10 ideas, I can ignore 10, and I know I'm getting an 11th. So we've had a few that we've kind of kicked around and we haven't executed, but this one's really good. So as we're ending up on this 2021 NFL season, I want to ask a simple question. What are the worst five franchises to be right now? I mean, that's it. Like, I mean, you can go ownership, you can go roster, you can go staffing, you can do all these different things. And I reached out to a couple different NFL sources over this. So basically the premise is what, Cerruti? We're looking at the 32 teams and going, which are the five? And maybe we'll throw in a sixth there. As it stands right now, moving forward the next 2 or 3 years, which are the five or worst six positioned NFL franchises? Is that fair? Is that basically what we're doing?
I think right now there are six teams, definitely five, maybe six, that are clearly the basement of the NFL. And I was just kind of interested because I work on the New York podcast with John Yastrzemski, and the idea came from Giants fans. Like, they have, I think, the second worst record in the entire league over the last like 3 years. I think the Jets are the only team that's worse, which is sick for New York. And, you know, they think that their ownership is a disaster. They think their team is a disaster. And basically, they think that they are the most hopeless situation in the league right now, because at least you could say the Jets are. They have Zach Wilson, like, they're sort of building. The Giants, like, where are you guys going? You know, the quarterback isn't good. Roster's not good. The GM and the head coach don't nobody likes. So my thought was, what is that bottom group of teams, and what are the teams that are the most likely to get out of that in the next couple of years?
All right. Well said. All right. So let's go over win-loss records the last 5 years, because it's the five-year stretch here. The Jets are the worst at 22-58. The Giants are only a game better. So the worst two records in the NFL over the last 5 years are the Jets and then the Giants. Third worst records, Jacksonville. Fourth is Detroit. Fifth is actually Cincinnati. But I think for the purposes of where they're positioned now with their roster and what we all think of Joe Burrow, they're just not in the discussion, although historically Cincinnati would usually be in this conversation because of ownership. But talking, and I'll get some of the source stuff here as well, because I talked to two national NFL people and then also a draft person, not Todd McShay. I wanted to kind of back up some of the PFF roster stuff, because they did a roster ranking stuff right before the season started. So again, one loss records, Jets worst, Giants, Jacksonville, then Detroit, then Cincinnati, Washington seventh, and a team that was brought up not only by my own observations here, Cerruti, but also by the people we talked to, Houston. Houston, actually, because they had a better record with Bill O'Brien than people realize. They're only the 11th worst record, but I think they make a strong argument for sort of the directionless place that franchise is right now. If you look at roster rankings, right, PFF ranked Houston's roster the worst out of all 32 teams this summer. They had Detroit 31st, the Jets 30th, Philly was 29th. And Jalen Hurts is, you know, he's putting up some numbers now. And I'm not going just off the Washington stuff. There's numbers that you can sort, and Jalen Hurts shines in some of that stuff. And a lot of credit too to how they figured out a better way to work with him. Jacksonville has the fifth worst roster based on PFF. Then it's Carolina, Las Vegas, Atlanta, Cincinnati, which is higher now because of who Burrow is. Chicago's 23rd because Chicago gets a mention. They have the Giants as the 19th best roster. I don't even think PFF would think that that's accurate now as we're through 2021. I don't. So I'm not calling them out for that. It's just what they are. Draft analyst, I asked him. I said, all right, give me the five worst rosters in the NFL as of right now, which, again, it's December versus when PFF did these things in the summer. He had, in no order, the Lions, Jacksonville, both New York teams again, Giants and Jets, and he threw the Bears in there. I asked, here's one national writer. I said, all right, give me your five worst situations. Projecting out the next 2 or 3 years, who would you not want to be? He put the Jets, the Giants, Detroit, Jacksonville, Houston, and he said potentially even the Washington football team. And then one other piece that we have on this, another senior writer, he put in Houston, Washington, both New York teams again, and then Denver. If you don't know the Denver ownership situation, it's a mess. For whatever reason, it hasn't been a big national story. It's a huge story in Denver. There's a trustee named Joe Ellis who's been with the franchise, I think, almost 40 years. And when Pat Boland died, he was kind of left to oversee the trust. There are children from two different women with Pat Boland. You know, look, he got married again, so whatever. And then John Elway, it feels like the Elway-Ellis combination has really just benefited from this for a long time. It's not ideal. There's just no way I can put the Denver Broncos in the five worst. I don't feel that way. So we can get to a bunch of different things here. Here's what's a constant. It's both New York teams. Jacksonville is brought up by two of the three guys. The Bears are worth discussion. Let me just, before we kind of come up with what we think the final list should be, because there's still some other thoughts I have on this. Like, where did you lean, Saruti? Like, what do you think some of the arguments here is if we try to whittle this down to five or six?
I think you have to look at, obviously, the last couple of years, and that's where the Jets and the Giants just dominate everybody else from a record standpoint. And then I look at, you know, because the ownership thing I don't know as much about, right? We can lean on our like insiders and our draft guys about like, you know, what, how easy it is to like get decisions and turn a franchise around, how bad an owner is and how much they meddle and things like that. I don't know about that. I'm looking at like cap space. I'm looking at what division they're in. I'm looking at their quarterback situations. And that's sort of how I determine my list. So like, I'd actually probably have the Jags. Like, I think the Jags could be a great job. And I think you could probably turn that thing around. Now, I don't know. Again, Shad Khan, I don't know anything about him. I know that he owns Fulham. I know he does like All Elite Wrestling, and those things have been somewhat successful, and the Jaguars have been a disaster. So I look at a team like Jacksonville and go, just on paper with like the cap space they have, the draft, they might have the number one draft pick coming up in Trevor Lawrence. Like, I'd want that job. If I'm a GM or a head coach, I'd be like, I could turn this thing around kind of fast.
All right, it's a really good point, because you can make an argument that you'd rather have Trevor Lawrence in Jacksonville. You'd rather be them. You'd rather be them positioned as bad as it is right now and getting the number one pick. The cap space thing, I would argue, is kind of irrelevant. The division thing can be cyclical. I don't think it's necessarily the same as like the SEC West and going there with Alabama there, because I also think with the NFL cap, like, if you want to get creative, you can get creative. It's just not the same way. Whereas an NBA team, if you go, oh, those are two really bad contracts and this guy's hurt all the time and doesn't even play, that can delay everything you're doing. But with the quarterback part of it, you can make the argument you'd rather have Jacksonville's situation over the Jets, over the Giants, certainly over Houston, over Washington. You know, if you were the Bears, would you take Trevor Lawrence in Jacksonville's roster and switch it out? Maybe not. I mean, there's still some defensive talent on Chicago's team.
I think I would. I mean, listen, this isn't a anti Justin Fields thing, but like, I don't take anything that happened this year with Trevor. Like, for Trevor Lawrence, like, I don't think he's going to be any worse or better. I think that was a disaster. Urban Meyer clearly wasn't up for the job. They didn't respect him. It is what it is. So I think next year it's almost like a gap year and they're starting over again. And I think Lawrence has the higher upside than a Justin Fields does. Like, I feel better about the Bears than I do about the Jets, even though both of them have their quote unquote quarterback of the future, because I feel better about Fields than I do about the Jets developing a guy like Zach Wilson. But if I just could take Trevor Lawrence in a bad roster and start from scratch, I would do that.
Yeah, I think the other thing with Cotton is that when I'd ask people about him, it'd be like, it's not that he's, you know, his track record here has been bad, but he actually wants to win and he's going to spend the money. And so the Urban Meyer thing reminds me a little bit with Dolan and the Knicks, although Dolan's had far more years to be open for criticism and a lot of the other stuff that he did prior. And Phil Jackson, you know, one of the weird things about hiring that big name is, am I getting you at the end of your career and you want the huge check? When Phil Jackson didn't want to do the job over and over and over again until Dolan was like, no, I can't stop paying your money. Like, I always laugh at Cowherd. I go, whatever your last deal is, I don't want to sign that one. Because I go, you'll be just mailing it in. You're going to have a place in Hawaii. I'm just kidding. I'm messing with Cowherd. But there is a tendency with people with huge resumes, when they think they're done and they get one more massive check and they go, all right, I'll do this for a little while. And I don't know if that's what happened with Urban or he just didn't understand the NFL part of it. But in a vacuum, if you're Shad Khan and you've gotten it wrong a bunch of different ways, you go, hey, why not just hire a guy who's won every single place he's gone and understands football? I'll bring in Urban Meyer. And then you don't realize that there's a complete disconnect from the NFL side of it. And you've got to hit the eject button on that, not even a year into it. So people argued that as, even though it was a mistake, that Khan and Jacksonville are clearly motivated enough. The problem is like when I look at a Giants team, or you can even put Chicago and Denver in this. This is my other Alabama analogy. When Alabama's bad at football, it drives them crazy. All right. When Ole Miss is bad at football, it's like, it's still a pretty good time down here. And there's just a different standard that you kind of hold yourself to based on your own history. So when I see the Giants get thrown into this, I go, so, all right, the last three coaches are McAdoo, Shermer, and Joe Judge. I don't know what to do with Joe Judge. I'd rather have Zach Wilson than Daniel Jones, only because I think all of us would go, we're still not 100% sure if Zach Wilson isn't any good. It's just less time in the league, and there's still more hope based on just a guy being in the league less, which is probably a flawed argument, but that's how we all work, and that's why people would probably prefer Wilson over Jones, but I'd rather have Giants ownership over Jets ownership. I'd rather have the Jets coach and front office structure more than the Giants coach and front office structure, because I asked the draft guy, I said, hey, give me the worst front offices in the league, and he was like, Giants. And
nobody likes Gettleman. Yeah, it's
right. Nobody likes Gettleman. And then the Raiders. But I think the Raiders thing is TBD at this point, because Mayock was basically doing what Gruden wanted anyway. So now, you know, I don't know how the structure of that works. So the one last thing on the Mara ownership with the Giants. OK, it's been a bad run. They've got the coaches wrong. Gettleman hasn't done a good job drafting. We don't like this roster necessarily. But what if the Steelers had a bad run for 3 years? You know, maybe they're going to be facing it, even though we all like Tomlin and Roethlisberger, they don't figure out the quarterback thing. Are we all going to suddenly say like the Rooneys are bad? No. And the Giants at least have a lot of history through this family where they've gotten it right. So I have a hard time putting Giants ownership as low as, hell, Washington or Houston or the Jets. Giants, you may not like the product, and this record's really bad the last 5 years, and the hope doesn't feel all that great. But I wouldn't start putting that ownership down with some of these other ownerships that we think have, I would argue, have given us far more evidence they can never figure it out. So
the other thing I'd say about the Jets and Giants is, you know, I think I would still rather be the Giants if I'm like buying stock in, or if I'm taking over one of these teams, because you have to look at history. The Jets do not develop like guys like Zach Wilson, right? We have Mark Sanchez. There's a bunch of quarterbacks and players that have, like, history have shown us that the Jets, it transcends ownership. I'm sorry, it transcends coaches, it transcends GMs, personnel. I mean, ownership, I guess, has been there and stable, but like they just can't figure it out typically. I mean, other than like the Rex Ryan years when he kind of had the defense going and they didn't have great quarterback play, they just haven't been able to develop that guy. Whereas the Giants, I go, okay, you probably know that Daniel Jones isn't the guy, but you're probably still a pretty high landing, like a desirable landing spot for a veteran quarterback, say Russell Wilson, if you want to pull the trigger on that. So I actually give them a little bit more hope. And like, I don't think their roster is good. I don't think they have a ton of talent. I think, you know, all right, they spent a lot of money this offseason on some weapons to kind of, in a make or break Daniel Jones year. But if Russell Wilson was like, hey, me and, you know, Ciara and I want to come and play in New York, like, he's going to want to play for the Giants, not the Jets.
I would think so. Let's try to come to a consensus on this. And by the way, we haven't mentioned Detroit. Detroit got mentioned by two of the three guys. And, you know, nice win against Arizona, but this is not the exercise. Like, oh, you can't do that. No. Like, Detroit needs to be mentioned here just because the run has been this terrible. I think it's the Jets, and this isn't an order. I think it's Jets. I think Jacksonville's still in there because we just haven't seen enough success from them. Other than that one weird stretch where they probably should have been in the Super Bowl, the front office did a really good job at that time putting that defense together. There was like five or six dudes on the team that were awesome defensively. You had the weird kind of Blake Bortles, is this guy going to be a guy year? And then it didn't really work out. And then it's just dismantled because I think a lot of the guys on that defense kind of had their own plans anyway and didn't want to be down there. So Jacksonville still has to be included in here, but Houston definitely has to be. And honestly, the Washington football team ownership, like, how do a worse job? Is it even possible to do a worse job than him? And you don't have a quarterback situation. I like their front seven like everybody else. But if it's six teams, it's Jets, it's Jacksonville, it's Houston, it's Giants, it's Washington, it's Detroit. Do you have any disagreement? Is it that the bottom six? Am I leaving somebody out? Do the Bears can't be mentioned in that, right?
The Bears made the playoffs. Like, what was it, 2 years ago? Was it last year, 2 years ago? I mean, I know it's not great, but I wouldn't put the Bears in there. And they're going to be, they're transitioning this offseason anyway. Like, I get the Cincinnati one too, because everyone says that the ownership isn't awesome, but they've actually had some nasty teams over the last couple of years. Yeah, they haven't won anything, but, like, you know, the Carson Palmer years with that defense, Burrow now. I kind of like that. And that's what I always think, like, the ownership situation, like the Giants, everyone thinks the Giants have terrible owners, but they did win two Super Bowls. But sometimes bad owners also have good teams. Like Jim Irsay, would you say he's a great owner? And I feel like they've actually been okay the last couple of years, and the way they have put their structure together and built that roster out, plus, you know, the Peyton Manning years, which were obviously great. So I don't know. Sometimes I think the ownership stuff and how much that bogs an organization down, I think you can overcome that. But I think of all those bottom tier teams, I would want to be the Jaguars the most.
Yeah, I think the Jaguars, because of the Lawrence situation, you would take that over the other ones that we're talking about. But I still don't think you can go 5-6 deep without mentioning Jacksonville. All right, sound off, man. Let us know how you feel. Probably not read any of the comments. Football wouldn't be the game we all know and love without a few surprises. And was there a bigger surprise, not just in Week 15, but this season, with the Arizona Cardinals going into Detroit and losing to the Lions? Now, to be fair, the Lions have been far more competitive than their record would indicate. And I think on the other side with Arizona, they're starting to hit that stretch where it doesn't quite look the same. Teams have injuries, but when you have injuries to your quarterback, Kyler Murray, and one of the best wide receivers in the NFL, DeAndre Hopkins, being out until potentially the playoffs, that is challenging. But you still think Arizona goes in there as a big favorite against Detroit and pulls this off. And they don't. And honestly, it was Detroit all the way. It was close early when they kicked it off. It was 0-0, but that's not the final score, because Detroit pulls this one out. And Dan Campbell, the head coach, I think somebody, all of us, when we see the videos, go, you know what? And it feels like an outdated way to coach, to be basically a Neanderthal in the best possible way. That's a compliment. But that's kind of an outdated thing. We don't like, even though it's weird, like, football's done business a certain way, and there's still a football part of football that has to always be there, because we're talking about men running out of a tunnel and running into each other for over three straight hours. And sometimes that has to be about aggression. And Dan Campbell buys in to aggression. He buys it by the scoop. And I like to see that kind of get rewarded, because it's very clear for the 53 guys that suit up every Sunday that are in that locker room, and after that kind of win, that they care about their coach, because they know that their coach cares about him. So maybe it's not as surprising that Detroit still fights, but certainly a big surprise that they would beat the Arizona Cardinals. Since we're talking about all things surprisingly great, we've got to shout out all the good neighbors at State Farm for offering surprisingly great rates. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Get a quote today. This is going to be fun. We got Austin Reeves, the Los Angeles Lakers, joining us. And you may have seen Miron Fader's terrific profile on him on The Ringer. And let's start there. What's it like, Austin? Like, there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about with you this season, and getting real minutes and closing minutes on top of everything else. I was watching the Dallas game. It's just been fun to kind of see your story. But how does the process work when somebody from, like, Lakers PR goes, or maybe it's an agent, says, someone wants to do a profile on you and make it a big deal? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy, because, I mean, you've got all these guys on our team, guys that have been in the league for, I mean, 15 plus years, and then they come to me and was like, oh, they want to do a story on you. So, it was weird, but it's like, I mean, that's good. I mean, I don't know if there's such thing as bad press, getting your name out there. So it was good, and Miron is – is fantastic, great person, and I feel like she wrote a really good piece.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she's like on a roll here, you know, Giannis MVP in the book and now Austin Reeves. So let's talk about your little town in Newark, Arkansas, where this all started. What's that town like?
It's just a regular country town in the middle of nowhere. Population's 1,100, 1,200. My graduating class was 50. So literally everybody knows everybody. Everybody either farms or usually stays around the town to work. But it's very simple. The one thing I really look back and love now is that there's no traffic. The traffic out here in LA is something else. But like I said, it's very simple, and it was a good place to grow up.
Do you like it in LA?
I do. I mean, I love the weather. I'll take the weather any day. If I can get up and throw a hoodie on and sweats, I'm good. Like I said, the traffic is ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, other than that, you can't really beat it.
All right. Is it true that you were freaked out by apartments that cost $1,000 for one bedroom? Because that's what it says in the profile. Like, have you adapted now to Los Angeles real estate yet?
I mean, I don't know if I've adapted to it, but I've kind of accepted it. It's not going to change. It's just the market's so different here than back home. Back home, you can get, I mean, like a place I'm staying at now, you can get it for a lot less than I got it now. I'll say that.
All right, so let's go from Oklahoma to the pre-draft process to, you know, figuring out where you were at. Like, what did you think was going to happen after Oklahoma?
I mean, I didn't really know. I was just on the fly, putting in work and hoping for the best and hoping for an opportunity to be able to prove myself. It's kind of how, I mean, basically my whole life in basketball's went. High school, didn't know if I'd play Division One, but really just put in the work and hope for an opportunity, and then there, so on, and got the opportunity here and trying to make the best of it.
What was that first Lakers experience? First time on the court, practice jerseys, lacing them up with Hall of Famers all around you. What was that day like? Put us back to that day.
Yeah, so it was probably when we went to the mini camp in Vegas that LeBron puts on. Most everybody that was there, I think the first day, Doe wasn't there. And AD just, I think, recently had got married. So he wasn't there. But that would be the first time that, and it's crazy because there was no practice jerseys or anything. It was literally like all team or all player driven. But it was the first time that I was taking the court with those types of guys, with Braun, Melo, Russ. So it was like a surreal moment. I remember we was just running through actions. We didn't do much playing, but we was just running through action, and Braun threw a skip pass from one of the wings to me in the corner. And I was just sitting there thinking the whole time is coming, like, what the hell is going on? Like, I'm really in a gym with six Hall of Famers, or at the time five, and 10 guys that have been in the league for 12 plus years.
At that point, were you a camp invite? Like, did you know your contract status at that point, or was that solidified, or still kind of uncertain?
At that point, I was still on my two-way.
You're right.
Yeah, so, and then they had told me and Joel Ayayi, which is with Washington's G League team right now on a two-way, that we were invited like 2 days before it started. So we got a plane ticket and got out there as quick as we could.
All right, so you make the team. I mean, there has to be, look, you know, you've been playing basketball your whole life. You get some of those dynamics. I've been watching this game for a long, long time. There had to be a moment of like, who the fuck is this guy? To, oh, wait a minute. we might have something here. Like, give me the beginning to when it got to the point where it's like, oh, whoa, there's a little something here. Because shit, I'll admit it. When I watched you in the beginning of the season, I was like, man, he's getting minutes with them. And then I'd go, wait, I think he's one of their better options. So give me the noticeable doubt to the acceptance.
I don't know if there was just one situation. I think it come over time in practice. And playing in practice, it was just situations where, I mean, I really didn't care who I was guarding or what was going on or who was on the court at the time. I mean, I would just play as hard as I possibly could and try to do the right things at all times and be someone that that's a sponge and that I mean, can take someone giving me criticism and really just take the message out of it and get better. And I seen that, or I feel like they seen that that's all I'm trying to do, is get better and do the right things to help our team. So I think it was just, constantly doing those things over and over again, throughout preseason, really like built their trust for me.
Have you had buddies come out to visit? Like, do you have to tell guys, like, don't, like, not yet, not yet? Because if I were your friend from high school or whatever, I mean, you'd have a hard time getting rid of me, man.
Yeah, well, no. Most of my friends work, which they can't really just take off. But my mom's been up here two separate times, and she's actually coming back at the end of this month. And she's also a couple of my friends are coming as well, so. We'll see how that goes if they end up wanting to leave at the end of their stay.
Okay. I know, you know, look, you're a younger guy. You don't want to get in trouble here. But there's got to be some LeBron stuff or even a Russell Westbrook. Like, give me the story where you tell your buddies about, like, oh, Westbrook said this to me or LeBron said this to me. Like, the stuff that just kind of, like, you can't believe that this is actually happening to you. I'm not asking for something critical. I'm not doing that. But, I mean, like, help us, like, share a little bit of what that relationship is like and how it's grown and kind of, like, maybe the moment where you called one of your buddies from high school and be like, dude, I got to tell you something that happened today.
Yeah, I mean, the one that stands out to me for Russ, and it was even basketball related, we was in Sacramento for a preseason game, and I went like 1 for 8 from three, like 2 for 9 from the field or something. Had a good game, I just didn't shoot it well. And in the locker room, he comes up to me and was like, "Way to shoot it." And I'm sitting there thinking, like, what? Like, I shot literally like 20% from the field. And he was like, "No, I don't care. Like, I'm just happy you shot it." And I was like, "Oh, well. That's kind of cool. I mean, I got one of the best assist mans to ever play the game telling me he don't really care about me missing or making. He just wants me to take the shot when it's open." So, I mean, it's just things like that, both of them. I remember Brian come to me in a game, regular season game, and basically said the same thing because I missed like 2 or 3 in a row. And he was like, "Look, if you're open, I don't care. Like, shoot it every single time." And then on top of that, it's just, I mean, regular life stuff. They're big kids. They just want to have fun, which I feel like a lot of people don't put into perspective. They're put up on this hill of they got to do everything the right way, act the right way, which they do, and they're good people and genuine about it. But at the end of the day, they're big kids that want to have fun playing basketball.
What's the funniest thing an opponent's ever said to you on the court?
It was I thought it was kind of funny, but it was the second game we were playing, I think, Phoenix, yeah. And I didn't play the first game, and then I had a DNP going until like the fourth quarter or whatever, the Phoenix game, and Jay Crowder made a comment to me about, well, they might need to play you a little bit. Like, it was kind of like, he's saying it as if, like, we made a little run when I got in, but he's like, "Who the hell are you?" Basically, that's how I perceived it, but I thought it was kind of funny.
That's, I think, the story here. I mean, it's not just, okay, the humble beginnings and, you know, hey, he made the team. You're closing. You're playing closing minutes, even when the team is healthy, which has not been the case. That in itself, like, that's a different level. Like, how is everybody handling that? How are you handling that? That you're, it seems to be part of the preferred five when everything's right with this Lakers team.
Yeah, I mean, I just continue to tell myself at the end of the day, it's just basketball. You can go back to high school and really just rely on your instincts and playing the game the right way. And I feel like, especially at this level with the guys that I have on my team, if I just stick to that and do the right things, then they're going to take care of basically everything else. Just play as hard as I possibly can, and things will work out in a good manner.
All right. So I've asked a couple different guys that have coached LeBron, and I go, all right, give me an example of like how he sees the game. And everybody, anyone I've ever asked this question that's either played with him, coached him, or been in the front office, like, you have no idea. Like, you think you know, but you have no idea what this guy sees and how he sees it. And I don't really know if that can be a learned thing. I think it's kind of like that Jason Kidd stuff where you have to kind of be born to see the game the way some of these guys see it. I don't know if that ever can be developed. What are some of the things that you've learned from him from a basketball standpoint of like, oh, okay, so we're in film and then he did this because he already knew this guy was going to do this and that guy was going to do all that stuff. Like, that's where I think LeBron, you know, does separate himself from his generation probably.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think a lot of the seeing the game in a different way comes from the preparation and really just being around for X amount of years. I mean, he knows every type of defense that teams could possibly throw at him. He knows schemes of the coaches that he's played in the past or that we're playing that night. So he knows all that. Then on top of that, he knows where everybody should be at the right times. He knows where people, like to catch and shoot, where people like to cut, and just things like that. So I think it really comes off like preparation. He made a pass in the, I want to say the Chicago game, but he was in the post and he tried to make a bounce pass from like mid post on the right side to the corner. And it went off of, I think, Russ's foot on like he was pinning in. But I was just like, if it doesn't hit his foot, it goes to Melo wide open three corner, like, and nobody else is making that pass. So it helps that he's 6'10", 6'9", that you can see on where everybody. But, I mean, I don't think it really matters because he knows where everybody is on the court at that time.
Have you ever played him one-on-one?
I have not.
Who do you play one-on-one, like Malik or something?
We don't play a lot of ones. I feel like that's going to be a summertime thing. We kind of got a older team, so they take a lot of the days off. And we really just do a lot of skill work. We probably do like two different sessions of skill work and then shoot throughout the days.
Yeah, some teams it's kind of like a thing. Well, they'll like there's guys that always are going at each other or whatever. I can imagine LeBron probably wasn't like, okay, the first thing I need to do this week, Austin, like we're paired off. You know, AD's down again. You're dealing with COVID. A lot of guys, you know, a lot of teams are dealing with this. I know the loss last night. You're in Minnesota right now, correct?
I actually just got back to LA yesterday.
Oh, you just got back. Okay, all right, all right. So, How do you feel about, you know, I know it's kind of like a tough spot because these are two different things. It's your own pursuit of like, hey, I'm carving this thing out, but this is a Lakers team with expectations and, you know, they just haven't had the roster right. What's your sense of what the problem has been so far this year?
It's been a little bit of a lot of things, to be honest. We haven't been healthy and then COVID's hit us. I mean, just right before COVID started, like really getting us, we had won, I think, 6 of 7 or 6 of 8. So we kind of got things moving in the right direction, and then we take a hit. And then it's really like, it's hard when you got, guys that, haven't played in 2 or 3 games to step in and play. But, we've had guys step in and play well. So we're just going to have to need that just to keep going around and around and really just get some fuel and continue to get better. Because, I mean, like I said before, we haven't been together for 5 months. This team's really new to each other. I think we have three guys that was on the team from last year. So even just the aspect of, like, schemes, coaches' schemes, there's a built-in, like, scheme that we know will work, but it's like you got to know people's rotations and all that, so it just builds time. So on the defensive end, we've made a lot of growth the last month, but we just got to keep doing those things, and eventually when we get fully healthy, I feel like we'll take a step forward, and then we'll just keep moving in that direction.
What was the night like after you hit the game winner against Dallas?
I mean, it was a really good night.
You got a smile on your face right now. Now I want to. Like, did you guys stay in Dallas, or was it a flight out?
We did. We stayed in Dallas because we didn't play in Minnesota till I think 3 days later, or 2 days later, or whatever. So we stayed the night. We had some fun, and yeah, it was a really good day all in all.
You got fouled too. They didn't call that.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but once I seen it go in, I didn't care if I got fouled or not fouled. I was just deep.
That was a fun game because I was kind of like, all right, I kind of figured out, like, I kind of thought I knew what you were doing, you know, as a team. Like, I was watching what you guys were trying to do, and then those games get weird because everybody stays in for overtime, and then it can feel like you haven't run a good set in like three or four possessions. Because everybody kind of knows at that point, like, what you're trying to do, unless you guys completely go off script, you know. And that's, you know, Westbrook hits that corner three, which they're looking to give him, and that's a huge spot. And then, you know, the way it got swung around to you on yours, I was like, was that? I have to remember the possession, so I don't want to make a fool of myself by asking, because I think it was just a swing, a reversing of the basketball, right? Was that by design? I don't think it was it?
No. So we basically. We drew up a sideline out of bounds play to get LeBron the ball, and we had been giving him issues with like a little big ball screen with Wayne Ellington because he had been shooting it well, and so Wayne was going to set like a step up and slipped out because they doubled, and I think they had a foul to give, so they was trying to foul Bron, and so he gave it up quick, so we had numbers on the backside, and then Wayne swung it to Russ, and I was like, oh, he's wide open. He's going to shoot it. So I was like, I'm going to go offensive rebound in case he misses. And then that's when I seen Russ, like, literally stop, look at the opposite goal to see how much time was left, and then put it on the floor. And I was like, oh, shit, I better run over here. Like, I'm open. Like, I know I'm going to be open. And he made a good pass, and luckily I made a big shot.
Yeah, that's trust, man. That's not. There's some guys on the wing over the years have probably seen Westbrook put that shot up. So I think that was a really cool moment for you. All right, I got a couple quick things here. In the piece, it said that your agents, like, was it when you made the team or was it your first game, and that you actually did pick Denny's as the place that you wanted to eat? Is that true?
There's some truth to it. It was me, one of my agents, and my mom. And it was, I think, like 10, it was probably like 11 o'clock at the time when the game got over. So there wasn't like much open. And we were trying to stay around the hotel that my agent was staying in. And I was so hungry at that point that I pulled up my maps and the first thing I seen was Denny's. So I was like, hey, let's go. Like, I've had Denny's before and it's good enough.
How many times, if you're walking around L.A., Austin, and you tell 10 people you're on the Lakers, how many people believe you out of that 10?
I would say the number's growing now.
All right.
But before this last road trip, I would say like 3 maybe out of 10. So, I mean, at least it was 0.
Have you felt like you're comfortable enough to – I'm not going to ask where you live because I don't want to blow it up. I think I know where you live, but and I know that just sounded creepy out loud, but I kind of know, like, you know, the two-way deal, and you wonder if you're playing for the LA Lakers or the South Bay Lakers. Have you explored the area and thinking about, like, where you might want to live?
I have. I mean, there's a lot of nice areas around. A lot of people live. I mean, just around in the beach areas. So I've been around in, like, Manhattan Beach area, Marina Del Rey. I mean, they're all really nice. It's just a matter of where.
You should see if Chandler Parsons has any room in his Malibu estate. We can make that connect. that's not an easy commute, though. All right, last thought here. This is for hardcore listeners of the podcast. You may not know what the hell, you're not going to know what I'm talking about. Well, I have a friend who played for the LA Kings a long time ago. His son is named Sully, and he was born actually in Manhattan Beach when he was playing for the Kings, but they're from Vermont. So he's back in Vermont, and it's a kid named Sully living in New England, and he's the biggest Lakers fan. And actually, Westbrook's his guy, so that's one. LeBron was two, and now Austin Reeves has passed him. So I think there's no way you're ever passing Westbrook with Sully. But you are now number two ahead of LeBron James on his own Lakers power rankings. So that's a pretty big accomplishment. So I don't want to let that go to your head.
No, I love that. I love that. I mean, I feel like that might be the only power ranking I'm above LeBron, but hey, I'll take it.
Yeah, his dad sent me a video of him, and he was losing his mind after that Mavs game. So he was pumped. You're inspiring him and many of us undersized skinny dudes trying to make a name for ourselves. So look, it's been a really cool story, man. And it seems like you're really grounded and you're enjoying it. So thanks for the time today, man. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwich is done right. Can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible. When I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. La Quinta by Wyndham has everything you need for your next business trip. From free high-speed Wi-Fi to fitness centers to free bright side breakfast with fresh waffles, eggs, and more. Book direct at LQ.com. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine.
Michael Wolff is one of the most accomplished writers, especially when it comes to profiles. He's written for every major outlet. I know probably a lot of people have read some of the stuff in Vanity Fair, Fire and Fury, the book came out about the Trump White House, and most recently this year, Too Famous, The Rich, The Powerful, The Wishful, The Notorious, The Damned, and Michael Wolff joins us now. What's up, man? Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I think about your career and reading you, and, you know, it's always kind of probably weird to be in your position to be like, all right, hey, how do you do this? But I think what I like about you is that you take on topics and you write about some of the bad people that are out there. And instead of just saying, hey, the bad people are bad people, what experience do you want the reader to have once you've kind of shared a profile on some of the public figures that their approval rating seems to be as low as it is?
Well, I guess I want them to have the experience that I've had. So I generally actually don't come to this with any kind of particular a bias, certainly not a political or an ideological bias. I'm interested in the story. I mean, you know, bad characters are often the most vivid characters. And from a writer, well, you know, that's the thing that's most well, fun to write about. I mean, you forget the fact that they're bad people, which they often are very bad people. they are also sort of extraordinary people. Their badness has certainly influenced the times we live in, but it is also often a function of them being different than you and I. So therefore, intrinsically something fascinating to read about.
What do you think is that common through line then that separates the people that you cover and maybe the average person that can never understand that world?
Need for attention, hunger for attention, obsession with attention. So the ultimate bad person may be Donald Trump. And obviously he exhibits this kind of extreme need at a level even higher than the other people with this extreme need.
Yeah, your access to Trump, I mean, imagine that goes back to just you being in New York City as long as you have, right? Like, this is somebody you've known a long time, correct?
Yeah, I was at New York Magazine for quite a number of years, and one of their steady columnists, and Trump used to call me up quite frequently, usually to complain about something that, or often to complain about something that might have been said about him, but more often to complain when something wasn't said about him. Why am I not in that article? I should have been in that article. That's all about me, and you didn't even bring me up. Blah, 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 blah. Endlessly.
And that's, I think, what was kind of, you know, retroactively funny about Fire and Fury is that you had all this access because you had the relationship. And then there were so many people that were upset with what you were quoting that, I don't know. So the motivation behind, I didn't say that, I kind of look at like, okay, there's two parties here, an author that would have just made this up or somebody that doesn't want to admit that they said this about somebody else. Is that kind of the root of the access and why that book became so successful?
That was the root of the access. And then I also had a relationship with Steve Bannon and kind of other things that sort of in a random way, you know, I mean, people always said, well, how do you get such incredible access? And the answer is, I don't know. It just is a confluence of circumstances. In fact, most of the time, I don't get access. Some of the time I luck into these this great opportunity. And often when other people are sort of shying away from, I don't want to see that person. That person's too horrible, but I don't want to get near Trump. And I was like, okay, I'm glad.
Yeah. And so what I loved about Too Famous is that I remember we had, back when I was working at ESPN, we had Larry King on just because every now and then Larry King would come on, right? And Trump was running and nobody was really taking it seriously. And we were like, hey, tell us about Trump. And Larry King goes, he has no sense of humor. And he's like, he has no sense of humor. He doesn't think anything's funny. And I was like, all right. And it was just such an interesting thing. And yet when I read this book and some of the Trump pieces, when he makes fun of Giuliani, I can't get enough of that. I don't know it is.
It's actually not true. Trump is funny when he is making fun of someone else. Then it's hilarious. And everybody thinks, oh, you know, everybody around him suddenly thinks, well, you know, this is, he knows something, he understands something, but it is only in that limited aperture. I can make fun of someone else.
Giuliani comes off as maybe the least impressive person that you profile in the book. Yeah. Can you give us more depth and insight on his transformation?
I think he is kind of a tragic figure. You know, in many ways, Giuliani was a good or at least interesting and certainly notable mayor of New York. As a matter of fact, he is the only, I believe this is true, the only Republican vote I've ever cast. I think a lot of people had complicated feelings about him in New York, but certainly they took him seriously. In many ways, he deserved to be taken seriously. And then he's no longer the mayor. He tries to run for president. That doesn't work out. He yet marries again another person with whom he's incredibly unhappy. And he has this, you know, come 2016, he has this. Again, an overwhelming need to be at the center of attention. such that he will do anything. He will humiliate himself. He will humiliate all the people around him. He will he will do things which don't make sense in any universe. He will betray whatever reputation he has had in the past just to be noticed, just to be on television. So yeah,
and at the end, yeah, and at the end, as you point out too, it's he basically was just going on TV screaming about Trump and then hoping to make money off of it, and yet was Trump like, nah, he knows the deal, like we're not going to pay him.
Right, that's totally the arrangement. And remember the other important point of this, he's drunk all the time. You know, so it is really a life that is in just serious overtime in every possible way.
You had a relationship as far as covering Harvey Weinstein, and it felt like in the book, as he's talking to you, as he's facing these charges, and it's almost, I think the timeline is he's almost close to sentencing here. It felt like he didn't quite understand the magnitude. Is that a fair way?
Oh, my God. Completely delusional. You know, I mean, I'm sitting with him and he's trying to get me to write a book about him, which I'm not going to do. But that doesn't dissuade him. He keeps going on. And it's like, well, if such and such, I will do this and we'll do this. And then it was like, well, what if you get convicted? he kind of looks surprised at even this notion. And then he turns to one of his people and he said, well, would I have to go to jail right away? Yeah, you're going to be convicted of rape and all kinds of violent acts. Yeah, they're going to cart you off. Totally had no idea. And this is literally weeks before he was in fact convicted.
Did you talk to him once he was convicted?
I did not, no.
The end of the book is, I mean, this peaks, you know, we build towards something, and that's the access with Jeffrey Epstein sitting in his mansion in New York. He's with his lawyer, and I think he's with kind of a diplomat overseas. I forget
the former prime minister of Israel.
Right. And then Steve Bannon's in there, and I've read about Bannon a bunch, and I have to admit, every time I see kind of Bannon in the room in a book, I end up more impressed with him than everybody else. And in this case, you basically have the transcript, which everybody's freaked out about, like how you even had access to the transcript of how these conversations happened, where it felt like Epstein was trying to strategize with his lawyer and the diplomat, as they felt like if we just tell our story, we can get out of this. And Bannon's on the phone and just being like, you guys are delusional. can you give us a better understanding? I mean, the book does it perfectly, but for the people listening, the understanding of kind of how this storyline played out is Epstein felt like he had a pivot here, a last minute pivot to somehow get public opinion, not on his side, but perhaps neutral, which seems impossible in the face of that story.
Yeah, well, remember, we're still before the crest or the crisis of this. You know, he hasn't been arrested yet. He's still an incredibly bad guy, and everybody is saying he's kind of a monster, but it's not really everybody yet. In fact, at one point, Bannon says we should test this. You know, we should go into the, run a poll, among people outside of New York and Los Angeles, and let's see if those people even know who you are. If they don't, maybe that's the place to start to rehabilitate you. So he's still, Epstein's still, and there's this kind of long slide, a many year slide of the increasing rancor against Epstein. And finally, at this point, and really, this is, I mean, the piece is called The Last Days of Jeffrey Epstein. And this is in the few months just before he's arrested and then he will die in jail. And so he's having, in the first part, he's having a meeting with the former prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, his lawyer, Reid Weingarten, and Bannon. And everybody is trying to tell Epstein that he's in trouble. His lawyer says, this is bad. This is heart attack bad. And then Epstein kind of jokes and says, yeah, but tell me what you really feel. I mean, Epstein is joking throughout this. And then they're talking about, well, maybe he has to go on television, possibly on 60 Minutes and, you know, kind of doing, a mea culpa. Yes, I was a bad guy. But now I've, you know, learned my lesson. Bannon says, then his lawyer says, well, you know, if we're going to try that, you know, we should prepare. This could take a, you know, a month. And then Bannon says, a month, it'll take a year. But then they go into preparation, and I have the transcript of this media training that Bannon does with Epstein. It's on videotape. It's what a PR person might do with his client. And Bannon is trying to be the tough interrogator. And then Epstein, who has never been on television, never done this before, is trying to answer these questions. There's a scene in Paris where, and this is literally weeks before flies back to New York and is arrested, in which he's trying to hire, he can't hire a PR firm. Nobody anywhere. That's how bad Epstein is perceived at this moment. You know, PR guys whose job is to handle, is to help fix people with ruined reputations. Even they, nobody will take take him on as a client. But he finds a firm in London that's previously represented a bunch of dictators. Gaddafi, etc. And they come to Paris and they say, yeah, okay, we'll do this for and their price is $3 million a month. And then he comes back to New York, gets on the plane, comes back to New York and is arrested. And then the last scene takes place with Epstein in jail. And the day he dies, he dies on Saturday morning. That Friday evening, he writes a friend and says, you know, telling him that he's still okay. And he says, still hanging around. And then hours later, he is himself hanging from a rope, a sheet, dead sheet.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm aware of the doubts of Epstein killing himself. What were the conversations like in your circles of people that are plugged in and knew
this? You know, I think it was, it's very clear in its absolute lack of clarity, which is to say, there is no way under the sun, a human being, not to mention this human being, could have killed himself in the way that everyone says he would have had to. Essentially, you would have to break your own neck. That's just it just defies physics. At the same time, were Epstein to have been murdered, essentially that would have meant that a half a dozen assistant U.S. attorneys plus another half a dozen FBI agents would have entered into some monumental conspiracy to hide this. So there's no way he could have killed himself. There is no way he could have been murdered.
There's a lot of discussion about, you know, again, we met 10 minutes ago here, discussion about just having the access to this transcript.
I feel though I've known you all my life.
Well, thank you. I look forward to the profile. It's not a matter of like, you know, how did you get it? Because I know that's not what you're going to be telling me here. But this kind of access to have it. I mean, it really, that chapter alone, I mean, the book is great. But when I end on that chapter, I'm like, I'm so glad I read this. Because, I, you know, if I didn't know you or somebody explained the book to me and said, oh, it's a bunch of profiles of famous people that are terrible, I'm like, all right, do I want to spend 300 pages on that? But no, it's so revealing and it's so insightful. And then you take on the topics. It's not like, hey, this guy's bad and here's why he's bad. It's just, hey, here's this person and read about him. But to have us in the room as they're prepping these fake media interviews. So this, does the tape exist or was it the transcript?
The tape exists.
The tape exists. Do you think we'll ever see this tape?
I don't know. It's Steve Bannon's tape. So I don't know. He doesn't, I gather, want to broadcast his relationship with Epstein, but who knows?
All right. So let's talk a little bit then about the role, because I think, I don't know if it's a generational thing. I don't know if it's, you know, kind of the climate of the last few years and how we take on these topics, but I could see younger, and I know you don't like the word journalist necessarily, but I could see younger people being like, well, why would you even want to sit down with a Harvey Weinstein? Why would you even want to interview all these different people? And I feel like there's been a shift where it's like, well, if somebody's bad, I'm just going to say they're bad all the time. And to me, that's not that insightful, and it's an incredible waste of time. Like, if I didn't like something, I wouldn't wake up every day and share with everybody like, hey, I think this is bad. Like, I think most of us that come from a certain level of intelligence just know that somebody's bad, and then we kind of move on with our own day. Do you think there's resistance to you for, I don't know if it's giving some of these people an audience or giving them time. I like what you do, but there seems to be maybe a push. And again, I don't know if it's from a younger generational thing of you being an outlet for some of these voices that are some of the worst people we've come across in the last few years.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I think not. I mean, you know, I've sold a lot of books about Donald Trump. People seem to want to know about that and seem to like the way that I do it. I mean, the way that I do it is I want you to be there as I was there. I want you to have the experience that I have had. I want to put you in the room. So I think that there is not real resistance there, but I think that there is this, we're in this black and white age. Oh, that's a bad person. I don't want to know about that. You know, on the other hand, you know, obviously, you know, there's been an enormous amount written about Jeffrey Epstein. People want to know about that. There's Netflix documentaries, there's on and on and on. So people do want to know. I'm just giving a different way, to know, I suppose. I'm you know, closer than any. I managed to get, at least in these instances, closer than other people. I mean, one of the interesting things about the Epstein coverage that I've observed is that nobody knows anything. Nobody knows Epstein. Nobody knows the people who know Epstein. The people who talk about Epstein are people who don't know, and the people who do know aren't talking. And I just sort of managed to slip around all of those obstacles and be able to see what has really been happening. So, I mean, I don't know if, you know, that's what I have to offer. If people like it, great. They don't like it, you know.
Because I read the New York Times profile, which I thought was really interesting, because the guy that did the profile on you, I think it was just a couple months ago, admitted that you'd kind of gone back and forth, but it was almost a respectful back and forth. But he had a line that I wanted to close on. He said that Wolf is finally finally affording the lifestyle he'd already been living, which was that a cheap shot, or was that somehow?
No, actually, that was my line. He merely took my.
Okay. All right. So, all right. It's a lot less nasty now than I know that you were saying about yourself, the success of the books recently. The New York social scene, as you reference it through the book, you know, the different people that are involved, whether it's the Huffingtons, whether it's Giuliani, whether it's early Trump stuff, you know, I think most of us look at it from the outside. I'm from Massachusetts. I love the city, but you know, it's not like I'm a New York City person at all. I think we look at this New York City social scene with the names and the politicians and the media, and we see it like is this imaginary world. What is that really like? Because you're in it, and I think the big part of your access is that you've been a New York City guy for a long time.
For a very long time. Yes, I mean, I think that is the point. I'm writing about Through writing about all of these people, I'm writing about the city I live in, the time I live in, all the issues that confront us. I'm just giving them a set of faces, good faces, bad faces, real faces.
I feel like the answer is just going to be a simple yes, but that world, is it fun? Is it worth it? Is it terrible? Is it exhausting? Is it necessary? And again, I'm afraid your answer is just going to be yes to all of those things, but I guess yes. I'm just...
yes to all of those things. But also, as a writer, I mean, you're there in you're next to things that are most vivid, most dramatic, most engaged with the moment. So I don't think you could hardly look for more.
Yeah, it is a wealth of storytelling. Too Famous, Michael Wolff. Thanks a lot for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Before we get to life advice, I want to share a couple recommendations. That 14 Peaks show movie on Netflix is incredible. This guy Nims, he's from Nepal. He was part of the Gurkhas, which I didn't know a ton about, special military force out of there. And he's just a badass of a guy. And he was into mountain climbing. And he was like, what's the best stretch to hike the 14 highest peaks, all over 8,000 meters? You know, we're talking Everest. We're talking shit in Pakistan. And he attempts to try to do it all within 7 months. And everybody's like, this guy's nuts. This isn't going to happen. So anyway, that was great. And then that Alpinist, which I had not seen, and I, you know, it's not like I follow mountain climbing. Guy's busy over here, about Marc-Andre. Those are terrific. So I went
back
to
that. Was that the Free Solo guy? He looked like the Free Solo guy in the Alpinist one.
I think the Free Solo guy is a guest that is interviewed.
Okay. That's why I saw him. Okay.
Alex, is Alex the Free Solo guy? Because I still
think that's his name.
Yeah. I got to now go watch that. So
that's the one.
Yeah, I'm not going to go out and buy a rig or anything. I don't see myself. I don't think I have the physique necessarily for any of that. But man, it was motivating. And I was watching it trying to go to bed. And then next thing you know, I couldn't fall asleep because I was like, this is sick. Didn't I just tell Saruti the story? Right? Because I just want to make sure I didn't do this on the podcast before.
I don't think so. But you're right. You don't have the body. Like, you're too bulky to be like a Free Solo. Or
you got
to
be like a jockey, right?
Yeah. No, you just have to be lean. You have to be strong and lean. All those guys are like ripped, kind of like swimmers, but even skinnier.
Way skinnier. Those guys are little.
Wait, so how does Chris Long get it done?
He's like a mountaineering guy. So he's not doing ropes. He just goes like whatever available paths are. And by the way, I've been hiking with Chris and he kicks ass. Like he's just.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Has he slimmed down post playing career? Has he lost some weight? Is he one of those guys or no? He looks skinnier.
He is a little skinnier, but. He has like, he'll admit too, he's not super pumped about his pec shoulder area, just genetically, which seems insane when your dad is almost like an Arnold Schwarzenegger type. But Chris has sloping, like shirts off. He's not into it. So he isn't. So it's honestly not even close to being as bad as maybe he thinks it is. But,
we could trade. I'll trade him his pecs for my pecs.
Yeah, he's not. He's a big dude in really great shape. And his arms are big. Like, I don't. Okay, let's keep breaking down Chris Long's
that's
body.
That's talking dude's pecs. All right.
Yeah, yeah. Just Jesus. So anyway, watch those mountain climbing shows. They're good. They're on Netflix. All right, life advice. LifeAdviceRR@gmail.com. Okay, the number of pickup hoops ones that are coming in are incredible. And this is one that we had. I hope this is still the same one. All right, let's see what this one is. What's up? Personal stats are actually meaningful. 6'1", 235. Ugh. A struggle with binge eating has kept me at a higher weight than I desire. I was about 170 1.5 years ago. Wow. All right, man. That's a swing. That is 65 pounds. All right. Tough year on everybody, though, right? So waver between being heavy and skinny often. I'm definitely decently overweight, but at least I got some good muscle to show for it as well. I had someone ask me a few days ago if I was a personal trainer and what to do to get my physique. So that made my day. All right, great. That leads to my predicament. I love playing pickup basketball, and it's probably the most enjoyable hobby I have. It's great exercise. However, I straight up suck at basketball. Did he say his age here? All right. More context briefly. I played for an awesome coach in high school at a tiny 100-person school, rode the bench. The same coach had an AAU program who pumped out some serious talent. Most recently, a first-round pick. Okay. I donn't want to give up anybody here, but yeah, this is a first-round pick. He'd bring a batch of ringers to my tiny school every season, so I never stood a chance of playing. In high school and early college, I wanted to be a college basketball coach. My life was spent absorbing as much information about the game as possible. I was a student manager for a mid-major team. As a freshman in college under a coach who won an NCAA title, okay, between that experience and learning from my high school coach, I have far more knowledge than your average basketball fan. I would think so. All this brings us back to our pickup basketball and my lack of skill. My background in the sport gives me the insight to know just how bad I suck at basketball. I know how bad I am more than the other guys in the gym who already know I'm bad, but part of it's due to a genetic condition and it makes me more susceptible to injury. 3 knee dislocations and I'm only 23. Jesus, man. That sucks. I'm always the slowest and most grounded guy on the court every time I play, and I'm not trying to get a knee dislocation number 4, so I avoid contact. Considering I wasn't even good when I was practicing hours each day in high school, I definitely am not good now. I have decent conditioning, a really good passer, and have a really pretty jumper, although I get in my own head too much, forcing a lot of misses. If I miss my first shot of the day, then it'll probably not be a great day. If I take more than one dribble, I'm definitely getting ripped. Can't guard anybody. A complete liability on D. Now that I'm 235 instead of 170, I want to hoop again because I think it's so much fun and a great way to get in shape. However, I don't want to be that guy that absolutely nobody wants on their team simply because they suck so bad. As a guy who's pretty good at pickup hoops, not anymore, I have 2 questions. How can I optimize my game? I try to play the high post a lot, pop out for 3s, but other than that, I don't have many options other than standing in the corner. Should I abstain from pickup for the sake of the 9 other guys on the court, or should I just go and because I enjoy it? I appreciate any insight on the proper etiquette here. All right, man, deep fucking breath first. You are driving yourself slowly insane just thinking about all this stuff. I mean, it's supposed to be fun, which is crazy that you still want to do it because you say you have so much fun. And this email makes me think you actually kind of hate love it. Like if the entire time you're like, I missed a shot, now I'm going to do this, or this is going to happen here. I think you love basketball. It's very clear. Your young life to this point, only 23, like your formative years have been around basketball, but you're just not good at it. All right. But I mean, I'd ask you this. Is there any chance you could do something else that you might enjoy a little bit more? And it doesn't sound like that's the case, but I kind of feel bad that you're driving yourself fucking crazy here just thinking about your pickup hoops game. As somebody who's obsessed over his own, I kind of get it. But at the same time, like, you feel bad. Like, the first thing you feel, like, here are your emotions that you feel in pickup hoops: shame, guilt. You know, like, that's not what it's supposed to be about. A lot of guys that suck just go out there because they want to run around and they're not thinking about this. So you're an overthinker to top everything else off here. So I'd almost suggest you find some other kind of physical hobby that you feel a little bit safer with. And maybe it's a hobby where people start developing their skill set in their 20s. Because, I mean, the problem is if you don't know how to dribble by the time you're 20 or you can't really shoot by the time you're 20, you know, that's a hard thing to do. I mean, it's one thing when you're 7 or 8 and you're fucking cartoons, juice boxes, and dribbling a basketball, and that's your schedule. You know, in your 20s, it's a little tougher to work in ball handling drills to get your game up to where you need it to be. So I'd ask you, how much longer do you want to put yourself through this anxiety of these pickup hoop games? And is there perhaps any other thing that you think you could get into where your knee wasn't going to get dislocated all the time? I don't know if kayaking. I know my dad liked that for a while. Trying to think what else? Rowing.
Racquetball, dude.
Racquetball.
If your gym has a basketball court, it may have a racquetball court.
Yeah, racquetball is pretty intense. But what I don't like about it is if you're an athlete and you don't know how it works, you get absolutely killed by non-athletes.
But you learn. So, yeah, but you learn.
I just was like, I'm not picking this up.
As a guy who's rolled my ankle at north, south, east, and west many times, like that's what basketball is a big danger for me. I'm fighting an ankle thing right now from stepping the wrong way, carrying grocery bags. So, you know, basketball has always been that for me. It was like, oh, here we go. How many minutes can I play before I'm going down?
Basketball is just you're picking up groceries?
No, picking up groceries is my new basketball is basically what I mean. I just mean, right. Basketball was never like my favorite thing, and I was never good at it. But my friends were always like, we got to play you. We need you. And then I just get hurt. So
yep. The other thing you could do here is you could scout out the worst pickup games. Like, yep. go find some older guys. You know, there are, of all the places that I've worked out and lived and all this stuff, there's usually always an older game. And, you know, if you're in your 20s and you're like, I'm going to dominate all these old guys, you're an asshole, which I'm probably guilty of a couple times. But, you know, you could just tell some older guys, be like, hey, I know I'm 23, but I've had like 3 knee dislocations and I'm not that good.
Speed.
And I just want to run around with you guys. Yeah. And guess what? When you don't dribble through them and dunk over guys, or you're working dudes off some crossover behind your back twice, when they see that you can't do those things, then they're probably going to be fine with it. So if you still love basketball, I would seek out an older pickup game where it's going to be your speed and you don't have the same anxiety. If you're out there at 23 trying to run around with other 20-year-olds that are really pretty good, and this is how you think, like, I'm surprised you even want to do it. You know, I remember, you know, back in the day when I was really, really, you know, I was really skinny for a long time, and I'd have these football games that I was in, and this youth football team, and, you know, I was on kick return because I was like, trust me, I was not wired that way back then. I was like, this fucking sucks. And like, the other guy was just as petrified as I was. And every fucking time the ball was up and it was close, he'd be like, you got it. And I'd be like, all right, here we go. And then I remember I broke one and I was like, that's way more fun. And then another time I thought I broke one and I ended up like in the bleachers. I was in, like, my arms and limbs were in the wooden slats of whatever the seats were, because I got tackled so far out of bounds, I just got mauled. And I was like, that wasn't a great time. So anyway, like, I can kind of understand the night before, the anxiety of, do I want to do this? But you're doing it in a game that no one cares about. Not that anybody cared about any of the youth football stuff that we're doing. But I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel bad that you think this much about a pickup basketball game and you're this frustrated by your own lack of skills. Suri?
Well, that would be my thought, is that I don't think he could play any team sport because he's going to be too much in his head. Like, if he picks something up tomorrow, he's going to be a noob at it, and it's going to take him time to get, you know, to get good at whatever it is. And he's going to be in his own head and he's not going to enjoy it. So my question is, can you enjoy any team activity if you're going to be too anxious about what other people think about you? So maybe you guys are right. Maybe like kayaking, some sort of, maybe climbing. I don't know. That's probably not great with the knee, but something that you do by yourself is probably your best bet.
Yeah, but with ropes.
Definitely with ropes. Somebody belaying, correct.
Right. Look at you, rope guy. You big mountain climber, Surdy?
No, I have a buddy that is, and he, it's funny, he used to belay at like the local Y, and he was like, teach me one day or whatever, and he like taught kids how to basically belay, how to climb the walls, right, the rock walls. And he got dropped 20 feet onto his back one time and was like, fine. It was like the craziest thing. He called me up and he was like, hey, going on? I was like, no, nothing, just getting out of work, what's up? And he's like, hey, could you come pick me up from the hospital? And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, I just fell like 20 feet on my back, kid screwed up, didn't, you know, wasn't belaying me right, and he ended up being totally fine. So it is a dangerous sport. Make sure you know somebody who's actually, you know, good at belaying. But I enjoy climbing. I think it's kind of fun.
Kyle, you ever climb
outside of like some kid's crazy party when I was like 11? I don't think so.
Running from the cops?
They had a small one at Gold's Gym, actually. They had a small one for the kids in the kids zone where I worked. But no ropes required for that. So I could touch the ceiling on that, but it wasn't that far to go.
All right. By the way, we had a lot of fraternity follow-ups from guys. Somebody emailed in, and I'm going to use the guy's name, the emailer's name, and just let him know. So Doug emails in and wanted to ask if the old person from Nationals was a certain guy's name, and he knew exactly who I was talking about. So, yes, Doug, you are correct. We were talking about the same person, the guy who, with Nationals, stole our house.
How do you get involved in Nationals in France? Like, you're just like a 40-year-old.
You got nothing to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, that seems like a last. No offense to anybody who's working for Nationals around the country who's a fan of the pod. I couldn't imagine being like after college, be like, you know what, I'm going to keep doing this thing. This is me for life.
I mean, when the National guys came to visit us, it was, Because whenever anybody's said, like, if you don't know me, like, I always feel like the people that know us the least criticize us the most. And I've had a couple times like, oh, figures that you were. It's like, yeah, dude, that's not really what we were up to. We weren't really super into it. The Nationals guys came by and they like rented a hotel room just to like talk us up and get us motivated about everything. And they're like, we want to read now from this part of, you know, the book. And I was like, oh my God. And they're like, if everybody can kind of get up, we'd like to do this circle of trust. And they're like, everybody can join hands. And I'm like, get me the fuck out of here. So
if there's anything I know you don't like, it's a circle of trust and holding hands.
Yeah, because the other thing is too, I would say throughout college, the handful of people I disliked the most were probably, you know, supposedly my brothers. Yep. Which was kind of the funny thing, because I was like, oh, you know, I don't know, like, you have to have, and like older guys are like, I fucking hate 20 of these dudes. What are you talking about? Like, we don't, there's no guarantee that we all get along. Which I thought was pretty interesting. We had a couple other people say, like, hey, sophomore second semester isn't that big of a deal. It depends on the school you're at. So here is an email, frat junior year second. So this guy went junior spring. Hey, college roommate, John. Oh, shit. Well, sorry. Whatever. That's pretty vague. That's vague.
I would say
enough.
There's a lot of Johns.
Yeah, there are probably more than one or two Johns who joined a fraternity. He joined a fraternity his second semester junior year, and it wasn't a loser move. All right. You know what? Congrats on whatever your odds were that it wasn't. It's still pretty stacked against you that if you do it, you're juniors. It's unheard of. And apparently everybody liked this guy. They all got along. They smoked weed. I'm sensing this one wasn't super intense, this fraternity, and that everybody just sort of hung out. And that's great. And I'm glad it worked out for that guy. I really am. But it just, it's pretty rare. And junior spring, we were talking sophomore spring. Junior spring is kind of unheard of. All right. We got one here. Let's see. Okay, there's one I want to read that's not a total life advice one, but I'm going to share it anyway because I do like the email. All right, 26. This is a life advice. 6'3", 240. Big. Very proportional, so I carry it well. On a hot scale, 6.5 with a high ceiling. So this guy's a couple shirts and maybe some golden goose away from a 7. Hey, guys. Recently left a job for a better opportunity. I was getting pretty burnt out at my last job, and fortunately, a recruiter reached out to me about an opportunity I couldn't pass up. On the downside of leaving is I've got really close to the people in my department, specifically one girl, just to put it simply. I'm infatuated with her. We get along great, always make each other laugh, view the world very similarly, and have moments that feel flirtatious. Plus, she's hot. Wow. Okay. Sounds great.
Package.
Link, please. All right. One thing that should be stated is she's in a long-term relationship. However, she's shown signs of hesitancy and uncertainty about her relationship. It seems like her boyfriend is ready to get married and start a family, whereas she does not and has said how she doesn't want to have kids. She's 25 and her boyfriend's in his early 30s. Now, circling back before leaving my job, I felt as if I had to tell her how I feel. So this is straight from the office then. If I didn't, I would have regretted it. On my last day at the job, after I said goodbye to my coworkers, I texted her to come downstairs and meet me in the parking lot. Jesus. Right outside of Dunder Mifflin, where it all goes down. That's not an email. When she came down, I told her I'm going to miss her. I have feelings for her. In a hypothetical situation, I wish I could see play out us crossing paths and being single. She was very taken aback, but oddly in a flattering way. I knew what I was going to say to initiate, but didn't have any plan of attack for afterwards. I wasn't planning on doing the you should be with me and leave your man speech. So we didn't do that. To summarize her comment, she obviously said she can't do anything because she is in a relationship. But if she was single, she would take me up. She said she's also going to miss me and said she loved working with me. Wow. That seemed to get the emailer's reaction because we got an eyeball emoji in that sentence. She told me I shouldn't feel weird about telling her this and that she was thankful that I did. So my question, I want to do more, but I feel like I literally can't. Should I reach out and try and slowly build up dialogue, or should I just let it be and hope fate falls in my favor? I'm not out here patiently waiting for her. I'm still experiencing enjoying the single life. But of all the people I met in my life, she's one of the few who I think could be my soulmate. Love the show. The emailer, he said, Russillo's segment about The Bachelor and all the dudes claiming to be professional athletes is a classic. I am very proud of that. And I would like to say one of the positives of the COVID testing and having all these extra NBA players is now The Bachelor and Bachelorette has a massive pool of guys now that can be former NBA players that retired on their own, you know, volition to then I just retired. And it'd be like, were you called up during the pandemic 3 though? Like, what, what were you actually? And it's going to be great. And be like, this guy was on the Lakers like for 4 days. So
still counts, all right. Dude.
All right. So back to this. I don't know. There's a few ways it could go. There's two primarily like top results here. Maybe she likes you. Maybe you planted the seed. Maybe this turns back around. There's a lot of emails, and I'll admit, even in my own life, there's a time where you sort of, hey, throw it out there, and then it's rejected, but the seed is now planted. So now that the girl looks at you entirely differently because she knows at some point there is an attraction or there was some interest or whatever. Once you do that, it's never the same, right? It's never the same. And depending on who you are as a guy, it can actually work out to your benefit down the road. So doing this, telling her how you feel, it sounds like you really do like her. Like, I still think this was the right call, all right? Because you don't know. You were processed in her eyes completely differently now, because now you've crossed over and admitting that you have feelings and you would like to be with her, all right? So don't feel bad about that. I guess we could get into some of the workplace dynamic, but the point is, people are going to talk to each other. Been doing this a long time, and you actually technically were leaving the job anyway. So, all right, you're in the clear HR-wise. Right. HR not going to get called on this one. Now, the other part of this, because we've had this happen to us too, is that she's telling you all these nice things because she doesn't have to date you, and she is dating somebody else, and you're leaving. So it could be very simple. You know, when somebody who says they don't want to hang out with you is like, oh, man, but if I could, I would snatch you right up. It's a really easy thing to say when you don't actually have to follow through on that. I don't know. I'm just the guy reading an email here. But I like what you did. I like that you kind of planted that seed for the future. And I wouldn't wait around on this shit because you don't know. You know, you could have been the trusted coworker. You could have been that Jim Halpert with no romantic threat whatsoever, and she kind of opened up to you complaining about some things. But think about all the relationships all of us have ever been in, the people right now that are married and generally happy. You ever bitch about your partner just a little bit to somebody else? You probably do. All right. Now, does that mean that you're going to get a fucking divorce and start dating the pool boy? You know what I mean? Like, it's not, there's a big gap between some disappointment in a relationship and, yes, I'm gonna make out with you outside of a chili. So I don't know the answer to those things, but I like that you did it. But what I would tell everyone, because you get a lot of this email like, hey, I love this girl, I'm into this girl, and she doesn't really see it that way. Don't be somebody's spare tire for life. All right? Because that's how they're gonna look at you. Now, maybe in this case, she really would want to date you, but this kind of speaks to anybody that's just after somebody and it's not working out. If it hasn't worked out after you tell the person how you feel and it's lingering, it's going on a couple of years, and maybe it's somebody who lives in your neighborhood or who you go to school with or at the workplace or in the same profession, and you run into medical sales, so you don't work for the same company, but you're running into this person all the time. If they reject you and you just keep pressing over and over and over again and it's just not going anywhere, and then you feel like, well, I need to check in every month. Don't check in every month. Check in every 6 months. But don't be somebody's spare tire forever, because they're not going to really prioritize you if they know that you're always there. And honestly, nobody likes fucking driving around with a spare tire anyway. I don't know if you guys have anything else. Kyle?
I would just say that text her on her birthday or reach out on her birthday. Leave all the other holidays alone.
New Year's is a good one. Right before the ball drops, be like,
oh, man,
I miss you. Or a minute before she's going to kiss her boyfriend.
If her birthday's in July, maybe. I don't know. If you're
New Year's is a huge one. That's a total mind fuck. Like, if it's an ex, you're like, I wish you were here. And then she's just like, what?
Yeah.
You're going to FaceTime from some weird party in Aruba. There's a guy in the background being like, is that Rosillo?
That's funny. I think that's it. Don't be annoying. And it's like, you planted a seed. Like, I bought 50 shares of MedMen, hoping that it takes off once, everything's all good in New York for weed stores. And I hope it's basically the 7-Eleven of weed stores in New York. And that's what you got your MedMen. Just leave it alone. Don't touch it.
You really have, you have a MedMen position?
Yeah. I got $40 at great price. So hopefully I've got like 200 shares or something. And if that ever takes off, you know.
You got 200 shares at a great price. You spent, what was
it? $40 or something. It was
40 bucks or 200 shares?
Like 20-something cents a share. I don't know what it was. But it just seemed like a good idea. MedMen's like nice. It looks nice, just like this person. And, you know, if everything breaks your way, maybe it works out. But you're never going to, if you keep messing with it and selling some and buying some, it's just going to drive you crazy. So just let it ride.
We got some financial advice out of this too.
She'll see you doing you, and that'll be good. That's the best thing you could do, is just do you and continue to be handsome in a seven. Good for you.
Do we really think that she was so surprised though? That's only my only thought would be, was it sort of like a defense mechanism and a like, oh, that's cute, but I'm not interested, because she was like, oh, I'm happy you told me that. But like, if she really, you know, was interested in you or saw something, and I get it, it's hard to break up somebody that you've been dating, and you obviously her significant other like is talking about marriage and kids, and so it's pretty serious. But I almost feel like her being too nice about it when you confronted her might be kind of a red flag, that she's kind of like, oh, I never really thought of you in that light, or maybe I have, but I didn't really see it coming, and that's why I feel like you're safe to talk to, but I don't actually want to date you. That would be
a work wife. Is that what a work wife is, or is that when you actually do something with someone at work?
No, work wife is not.
You kind of casually flirt, and you guys are like, you know, friends and respect each other and all that
sexual
stuff, right?
It's just like all so the stuff of a marriage without the good stuff.
Yeah, so maybe that was his work wife, and he was like, no, I want you to be my wife. She's like, whoa.
Or the bad stuff.
And that's true.
Yeah. All right, I think we covered that. There you go, life advice. Thanks to Kyle and Cerruti. I hope you guys enjoyed today's podcast, mixing it up a little bit. With Austin Reeves, obviously, with the Lakers, but of course, Michael Wolf as well. We'll be back on Friday. We're going to have a Friday episode for you. So a full episode on Friday, and we'll talk to you then. Thank you.